Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Daily Medieval Podcast. Now, last time we spoke about an incredible emperor in an age that was kind of, in terms of the fall of Rome, this was an age of kind of flourishment, prosper, of reform. And that was the age of Justinian. Today, we are looking at Gregory the Great, someone who grew up during that age, impacted by that age. We're going to see how the kind of themes that we talked about last episode are now feeding into the lives of those who are growing up and living in the aftermath of Justinian's reign. So let's jump right into it with Gregory the Great, someone who many people, especially if you do medieval history, many people will know who that is, but many people might not know the true story behind him. He's one of these names that's chucked about, you know, Gregorian, you know, Gregory's, whatever. Especially when you look at kingship, because he had very strong views on the relationship between church and state. But I was very surprised by the information that I found during my research on him that I just did not know. So let's jump in right into the life of Gregory from 540 to 604. So he was born into a wealthy noble family in around 540 in Rome. And like I say, this is in the aftermath of Justinian's rule. In fact, it's kind of coming up to Maurice. So we're actually towards the end of the age of Justinian. So we're kind of getting the full breadth of this kind of prosperous age of religious unity, of kind of remaking the empire, all this stuff, and reform above all. So he lived in Rome, which had been reconquered by the Eastern Roman Empire from the Ostrogoths. He was born into a wealthy family with close connections to the church. Now, what's particularly interesting here, I've never come across this before, but in the same way that we have noble families or royal families who have a dynasty of people who were, you know, emperors, princes, kings, whatever it may be, we have here a dynastic family which was a clerical family. Now, what I mean is this: his father was senator and prefect of the city of Rome and regionarius of the church. His mother was also a well-known saint, and has two paternal saints as well, his aunt, Drusilla and Emiliana. His great-great-grandfather was then Pope Felix III. So we have, in terms of religious dynasty, we have three saints. We have a pope. We have a prefect of Roman Regionarius of the church. He was the most distinguished clerical family of the period. So it's fascinating to see when you look at other kind of noble families who may be descendants of Merovingian kings and have been emperors and owned vast numbers of land, blah, 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 that you also see this in a clerical sense, in a religious sense, where people have lineages of saints, of popes, of, you know, people in the church. But during this time, although he was born into a very, well, very good family, he was born during period of upheaval. From 542, the plague of Justinian swept through Italy. In some regions, over a third of the population was wiped out. Now, this left a very heavy spiritual and emotional effect on Justinian's life, on the life of those around him, especially, like we said last episode, on the life of those ruling. In the 540s, Justinian attempted to recapture northern Italy from the Goths. We see that. So again, living through this. Tutilla, of course, then comes in 546 and sacks Rome once more, and went on to recapture most of all the territories taken by Justinian in Italy. There then is a Gothic war in 552, a Frank invasion in 554, a schism of the three chapters. And all of this culminates in a life that Gregory lives and grows up in and influences him kind of this idea that we'll see about unity, about re-establishing Christianity. And you can see why when you live in such a period of upheaval and instability. He was well educated. We see from a contemporary, Gregory of Tours, who wrote that he had exceptional Latin, but did not read or write Greek. Now, this is particularly interesting as it shows a slight division that although he grew up in the Eastern Roman Empire for the most part, which spoke and wrote in Greek, he remained in Latin. Now, this again is kind of the seeds, I guess, of the division that would soon emerge. As we saw in Justinian, there is a kind of that the West is starting to stray from the East. And I think we can see this here by the fact that he doesn't know Greek. He became a government official, eventually becoming prefect of Rome at only 33, which is very young. He, like Augustine, this is particularly fascinating, established the monastery of St. Andrew at his ancestral home at Rome. Now, we saw with Augustine, when his family perishes, he loses his wife, his son, his mother, his father, and he travels back to his kind of birthplace and turns the family home into a monastery. It seems to be that this is a thing that prominent noble family members who become ecclesiastical members of the church use their homes for. They turn their homes into a monastery, and we see Gregory do the same. Now, a painting made by the monks after Gregory's death reported him as bald, with a tawny beard, and a face that was an intermediate between his mother's and father's, which I guess you'd hope for anyways. He had long curly hair on the sides. His nose was thin and straight, and his forehead was high. So that kind of gives you a real kind of understanding of what he may have looked like. We see that he had a chin of comely prominence and beautiful hands, which is an interesting description there. But there we are. But that tells you what he was like, and he was a man at the border between the East and West, between Rome and Germanic worlds, and above all between the ancient and the medieval. I think that's what's so fascinating about him. When we see his life, where the birthplace that he lives in is constantly switching between, you know, the old Roman or the new Roman system and this Germanic system, tears between you, it must have. But on his father's death, again, we see ecclesiastical people being deeply interwoven with their families, with kind of grief, and use that grief to fuel their religious fervour. So we see on his father's death, he converted another family home into a monastery dedicated to Andrew the Apostle, which was later rededicated to Gregory after his death. And Gregory concluded that in that silence of the heart, while we keep watch within through contemplation, we are as if asleep to all things that are without. And he particularly devoted himself to poverty, to silence, and to prayer. And thus, when a dying monk was seen to have stolen 3 gold pieces, Gregory forced the monk to die alone and threw his body and coins into manure as punishment, saying that take your money with you to perdition. So he believed that punishment for sins could occur during your life, and he was very staunch on his faith. As we said, vow of poverty, of silence and prayer. So if you broke that, Gregory would not stand for it. But that being said, he did conduct over 30 masses to offer aid to the soul prior to judgment. And he viewed being a monk as the ardent quest for the vision of the Creator. But many are called, but few are chosen, which is very interesting. A bit snobbish, but there we are. And in 579, from being a monk and prefect of Rome, he now is chosen by Pelagius II, to become the apocrisiariate, which is the ambassador to the imperial court. So this is the ambassador to Constantinople. He was part of a Roman delegation that sought military aid from Constantinople against the Lombards. In his lifetime, there is now another invasion. The Franks had a go, the Ostrogoths had a go, Totila had a go, and now it's the role of the Lombards. With focus in the east, this was unsuccessful. As we know, Justinian and his successors were constantly plagued by the Persian War, and this is evidence of that. In 584, Pelagius asks Gregory to speak with Emperor Maurice, so this is the emperor who is right at the end kind of this period, who will be murdered by one of his soldiers, Phocas, ending the age of Justinian. Maurice, however, despite being a general, favoured diplomacy in the West by using the Franks against the Lombards. We talked about this briefly last week, but rather than send a relief force against the Lombards, he attempted to use the Franks through diplomacy against them. Somewhat successful at times, other times very unsuccessful. The Byzantines were far more occupied with the Persians in the east and the Avars and Slavs to the north. So, according to one historian, if Gregory's task was to plead Rome's cause to the emperor, there seems little for him to do once imperial policy toward Italy became evident, essentially saying, no chance that we're helping Italy. Papal representatives who pressed their claims with excessive vigour could quickly become a nuisance and be excluded from imperial presence. And we kind of see Gregory tiltering on this point as he pushes for Rome's aid. Now, Gregory had already drawn imperial rebuke from his critical writing on the legitimacy of the 32nd Patriarch of Constantinople, John III Scholasticus. Now, as such, Gregory worked closely to build a relationship with Byzantine aristocracy, especially women, but this seems to have little influence. But it shows you how people like, such as Gregory, in this role as a papal representative, are trying to wield a political game as much as a religious one to ensure that they have favour and to ensure that they can fulfil their role. But aside from this, Gregory was deeply involved with theological debate and had a bitter conflict with Eutychius over the nature of Christ. Now, citing the Bible passage Luke 24:39, Gregory affirmed that Christ was corporeal and palpable after his resurrection. Now, Emperor Tiberius II, after hearing this, burned Eutychius' writings due to this, and Gregory was forced. But what's so interesting is that Gregory was forced to rely on scripture, as he could not read the untranslated Greek works. So despite Eutychius having more at his disposal, Gregory, in a way, has to double down on the scripture because he cannot understand it otherwise. And as such, Gregory was elected as successor of Pelagius after his death in 590, which was caused by a plague that hit the city. And so we see Gregory now becoming Pope. Initially, Gregory actually wasn't a fan of the office, instead preferring the life of contemplation and prayer. Now, I remember, gosh, a while ago when the Pope was being elected, that I heard discussions on the news or whatever, that people didn't want the role. It's far too much responsibility, far too difficult, far too political, especially in this period when you're contending with kings and emperors. That it does detract from the spiritual life. We see one of his first acts as Pope was producing a series of letters disavowing any ambition to the throne of Peter and praise the undisturbed life of monks. So there's real resistance there. Note that the papal's power in the West was limited. It wasn't in the way that we think of the papacy, especially in the 12th century, 13th century. It wasn't yet to this position. Gaul's episcopacy was drawn from territorial families, Visigothic Spain was unconnected to Rome, and the Italian de facto lands were constantly being skirmished. So despite being the Pope, in reality, there was it can be questioned the extent of his power. But his mission was strong. He attempted to continue what Justinian had hoped for, a united Christian front. And so he re-energized Christianity in a non-Christian people, most famous of which is the conversion of Anglo-Saxon England under Augustine of Canterbury. And so we see that in this world that he grows up in, where Justinian had this motive, these policies of reform, of religious life, of conversion, that Gregory, some 40, 80 years later, also picks up these during this age of Justinian. It's clear that Gregory had not forgotten about the English slaves that he had seen in the Roman Forum, and a successful mission provided a base of operations to send missionaries to Germany and the Netherlands. So England was key in the conversion of Germanic Europe. And this idea of conversion and elimination of religious deviations is a consistent tenet that will be upheld by the papacy. By popular acclamation, he was made a saint following his death, and in official documents, he used the term servant of the servants of God, servus serviorum Dei, as the papal title, a practice that would be upheld by subsequent popes. And his most important works were the Dialogues and Moralia on Job. So he's a fantastically interesting person, someone who, as we say, upholds the tenets of the period, of the age that he grew up in, seeks conversion, but above all seeks a spiritual, faithful life of poverty, of prayer, of silence. And so there we have it. Thank you ever so much for watching. Have a good day, and see you next time.